This is the DRF Players Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the DRF Players Podcast. I'm your host, Peter Thomas Fornital, back with you, back in the Brooklyn bunker, Muggs, the handicapping Labrador, alongside for show number 250. It seems like just a minute and a half ago we were doing show 200. We've made it to show 250 despite the lax schedule with all the travel going on in the last few weeks. July 11th edition. Was just speaking with producer Craig about the fact that today is 7-Eleven and we're all eligible for free Slurpees, so we have that to be excited about. Muggs and I are joined today by our usual co-host. He is calling in from the planet Texas, joined by a friend of his own. He is Jonathan Kinchin. How are you today, JK?
I'm good. We're up against it. You're going to laugh, and people that know me are going to laugh. Someone actually made a joke to me the other day about why the heck I always have my backpack with me. And it's because you never know when you're going to need a handicap, so I've got to have my laptop.
Well, yeah, you live online, but you handicap all the time. I understand the backpack thing.
Yeah, well, I this morning I've got my son with me. We're running around, and I left the house. I left my computer out of my backpack. I just carried my backpack with no computer in it. So we're struggling. We have pancakes and bacon, though, from the little restaurant downstairs from the office, so we should be okay, at least for the time being.
Austin's cameos on the podcast have been very popular in the past, so if he wants to say hello at any point, that's fine. What was the funny thing he said after the last show? Do you remember what I'm talking about?
I don't know. He's upset there's no bacon, so they did us dirty a little bit with the bacon downstairs.
It was something to the effect of, man, you talk to that Peter Thomas Fornital a lot or something like that.
Oh, yeah. Well, he calls you PTF, so he calls you PTF, so. Well, yeah, he was a little bit distraught.
We do appreciate his not only appearances on the show, but being very patient with Dad when it comes time to talk to the listeners on what we'll be getting back into, hopefully, a twice-a-week schedule. And it's also a good thing that you didn't have that laptop issue on a day where we were actually handicapping races. I know your mind, it's like a steel trap. You'll be quoting fractions from the races that happened last weekend, but everybody kind of needs to at least have the paper in front of them when they talk about races, at least in a radio show format. So at least you don't have to worry about that.
Absolutely. No. And the good part about it is, well, I guess not the good part, is I didn't have a great weekend, so the results they stick in my head a little bit harder than normal.
I was going to ask you that, actually, because I know it's true for me with gambling. I remember the losses and I can basically tell you chapter and verse of situations where I was nosed out of big scores, or, you know, Arlington Million days where I was DQ'd out of big scores. I'll remember the names of the top three finishers, et cetera, et cetera. And then, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, that was that day we won 8,000 on the pick six, and I have no idea of a single horse who ran. Is it the same thing for you? Do the losses stick in the memory banks a little bit better?
The details of the losses. I mean, I can get over a loss pretty quick. I mean, sometimes it takes me a day or whatever, but I can get over a loss fairly quick. It's the details that I typically will remember.
Well, we've got a very cool show lined up for number 250. Later in the hour, we're going to have a guest, and this is sort of a guest by request in a roundabout way. When we play the tape of that, you'll hear exactly what I mean. The guest is Anthony Robb. Some people know him as Hurricane Anthony. Some people know him as Tony Gold. Some people know him as the nut from Australia, pretending that his crutch is a machine gun. He is Anthony Robb, and he's on the show because he managed to qualify for a big, important Vegas contest in, I'm just going to say, it's a unique way, and we'll get to the specifics of it a little bit later in the hour. We're also going to be talking all about the races from Stars and Stripes Day at Belmont, some really interesting goings on that supercard. That's going to be first up, and then we're going to close the show out by answering a question. Every once in a while, I get a question that I tuck away like a squirrel with an acorn for just the right moment. And this was we did something similar when we were talking about the Kentucky Derby. This is going to be our Saratoga preview question. where we talk about all our favorite things to do in Saratoga. Maybe we'll throw in a little bit of Del Mar, too, if we have time. We'll wrap the show with that preview. But let's start off with the races from Saturday. And I'm just going to give you a softball, JK, to start things off. Of the performances you saw on Saturday, which one surprised you the most?
Oh, geez, I guess it's the lack of performances that surprised me the most. I guess I was shocked that Shaman Ghost got beat. I didn't see a world in which that was going to happen, with seemingly no issue in the trip as well. And then our good pal Yoshida just really didn't pick up his feet at all.
All right, well, let's start with those two races. The Suburban won by Keen Ice. Buyer speed figure of 106 on the time form scale might have been rated a little higher. I think if anybody told us Keen Ice won a race, pretty much of any kind, you'd say, oh, there was some sort of pace meltdown. Keen Ice was able to take advantage of his late running and the sort of inherent class that he has and get the job done. But not exactly the case at all. This was a race that was coded blue throughout by Time Form US on the racing flow figures. It was a race that was absolutely meant to favor the front runners, and yet Keen Ice gets it done. What happened?
I don't know. What I thought you were going to say is if Keen Ice won a race, then that typically means that you and I were alive for a lot of money.
Well, that's the case anytime any of Elliot Honecker's horses, one of the members of the Donegal partnership, seems like anytime he wins a graded stake, it costs us a lot of money. So there's an immediate side question for you. Were you alive to a big score? That might explain it, the karma.
No, it wasn't. I mean, Yoshida really kind of cost me anyways, but
we'll get there.
You know, Shaman Ghost wins. I'm alive for some opportunities, but it wasn't like it was like a, you know, the last two times Elliot's beat me, it's been clearly his fault. So, the pace scenario, it's not one in which you thought he would excel at, but the idea that Keen Ice is found a way to successfully navigate a mile and a quarter races suggests that just might be his trip. And maybe Shaman Ghost is one of those horses that maybe needs to kind of gallop along a little bit more.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, you know, it's one of those situations we've talked about before. It's like when you have these horses that with getting seemingly perfect trips on slow fractions and they don't seem to fire, they're more grindy types and they're not the quickening type at the end of races. And they allow other horses to kind of get themselves into the race and then they struggle to beat those horses home.
But I mean, take nothing away from Keen Ice. I mean, this was a pretty fast time and a nice performance. Looking forward, are you suggesting that in a rematch in a few weeks' time, you'd be more in the Shaman Ghost camp, or do you think it's possible that this win by Keen Ice represents a new level of established ability?
Well, I mean, I think that a lot of people, no offense to Dale, I think a lot of people were interested to see what was going to happen when Keen Ice switched to Todd. Never really has had the success he had with Dale. But maybe Todd and his crew have kind of figured him out a little bit. And I would imagine he'd be a horse that would be dangerous moving forward. I mean, he'd be a horse that I'd be completely interested in playing in a race like the Whitney. I don't know if that comes back too quick, but he'd definitely be one that I'd be interested in.
You would be. So Keen Ice, you take him a little bit more seriously. You know, he's had the drought of wins since the Travers, I believe, and was sort of a horse that I would have, you know, considered for underneath, but probably would have. I mean, I don't think I see hanging a later grade on him before what we saw on Saturday. You're with me as well there, though. You got to at least, you got to accept this performance as not just the benefit of a favorable situation, but as something to be taken seriously.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, he didn't, you know, like we said, he didn't really have a favorable situation, and he happened to win still. Most of these types of horses, you know, I always feel like when I find a horse I want to play that was, was closing into a slow pace, they don't ever get there. So you're, you know, they ran second or third, and then you're betting them to hopefully win the next time. This horse actually got it done against a 3-5 shot. And so that's pretty impressive and something that I could definitely lean on moving forward.
Any other thoughts on the Suburban before we turn the conversation to Oscar performance in the Belmont Derby?
No, I just that I was right. The battalion runner's not that good.
No, we're gonna get there. We'll do that. We'll talk about the Dwyer as well. But let's go to the Belmont Derby first. And let's start. I know all of our listeners want to hear our explanation, if we have one, about Yoshida and what happened there. But let's start by giving the winner some credit. I do think there was some subtle pace dynamics that helped the horse. Timeform had it coded as slow to a mile. And, you know, that can be, in my view, an important thing when you're looking at races, especially 10 furlongs and farther on the turf. But, I mean, this horse, it came home quickly, 96 on the buyer scale. The time form number looks like a very straightforward figure, that seems like the level of ability attached to it. Nothing earth-shattering, but, you know, came home in decent time and got the job done. Were you impressed by Oscar's performance?
Yeah, I was. Unfortunately, I even yelled a profanity like at the eighth pole, because it was clear that he was not coming back to them. and I used him defensively in some multi-race bets. Like I said, I didn't have keen eyes, so it didn't really matter. But he ran well. Good for him, you know. And there's a lesson to be learned there. You know, when he first came back at Keeneland, I think we, you know, you and I had the conversation, and other people had the conversation, that maybe he didn't translate his form from 2 to 3. Then it turns out that maybe the ground wasn't to his liking that day. Then he shows up on Derby weekend, runs on the inside of what we've all been able to, I think, confirm was not where you wanted to be on that turf course. Arklow's negative performance with, you know, off of that is maybe something to another piece of proof to that. Then Oscar performance comes back. He wins the Pennine Ridge, and then he rolls it right into the Belmont Derby, going a mile and a quarter. It's lots of lessons that can be had there. One of them being that when you allow a speed horse to stretch out to a longer distance, it's not it's more advantageous, I believe, than trying to get a closer stretching out, because you're allowing him to go on the front end slower than he would have to go in a mile and an eighth race, allowing him to then finish.
It's a little counterintuitive to a lot of novice handicappers, but I couldn't agree more. It's the concept of EP horses. That's borrowing a term from the Sarton methodology, and one that I'm familiar with through the great Tom Brohammer book, Modern Pace Handicapping. But EP horses, the horses who are going to control the race up to the pace call. So you're talking about like the 6 furlong mark in a route, or the 4 furlong mark in a sprint. The horses who are going to be in good positions at those points in the race are EP horses. And when you have an EP horse that can finish, you know, to the degree, to at least some degree, and then you take this horse and put him in a dynamic, you know, I don't want to totally stereotype here, but there's no doubt that some stereotypes agree for a reason, and New York turf races not being run quickly, that's one of those stereotypes that I think is very much rooted in reality. I mean, are we at a point now where anytime you have a quality EP horse in a New York grass race, that you're going to give that horse like a little bit of an extra upgrade? Cause I sure am.
Yeah. I mean, it's frustrating though. Right. I mean, this wasn't a stakes race, and I've talked about a good friend of mine, Jake Ballas, and they had a horse that I'm sure a lot of people were expecting to do just that. An allowance race that started the pick 6. I think it was race 5, Mighty Mo. You know, I thought he was going to be loose on the lead, and next thing you know, he wasn't. So it's a tough thing. It's a tough thing to predict, and it's frustrating at times when you're trying to predict it. It's when you need them to go fast, they don't. When you need them to rate, they don't. When you need them to go on, they don't. When you need them to not save ground, they do. And it can be a very troublesome and frustrating game, but it all usually equals out in the long run. So you get bad trips, you get good trips, but. I completely agree with you, and I've joked about it before. You know, I said it's a race at Naira, and you're telling me there's going to be a horse that's going to be loose on the front end, and he's definitely one that has my attention.
And even if it's a horse who doesn't end up being like loose per se, just when you have that ability to be in the mix as they turn for home, it's just something that you got to give a little bit of extra credit to, I think, at this point in turf races in New York. And I get your point. You know, race design isn't easy and it can be frustrating. But, I caution you or anybody to not throw the baby out with the bathwater when it comes to this stuff. You know, it's not magic. The ability to sort of guess where horses are going to be at certain points in a race, you know, you're going to be wrong, you're going to be right. But really, the analogy that I think is dead on here is it's not the magician analogy, it's the card counter in a casino analogy. All you're trying to do is turn the odds in your favor that little bit by being able to have a clear picture in your race of how it's going to play out on the track, you know, a few points better than the marketplace to give you that edge to make it a worthwhile exercise. Agree or disagree?
No, I absolutely agree. Yeah, anything you can do to get an edge, and if you can find a pace edge, it's one of the strongest ones in racing.
Yeah, and it's not. I don't think you're going to still need to be a fundamental handicapper. You know, the percentage edge you're going to get from great race design is going to help you, but I don't think it's necessarily going to be enough to beat the takeout. You're going to have to be able to identify spots where you have a picture in your head, where you also, you know, don't want anything to do with horses who are going to represent enough of the betting pool to really tilt the odds in your favor. But it's just one of those things that's worth doing. And I just feel like I've still been consistently underrating certain types of speed horses. And Oscar Performance is the exact one who's coming to mind. You know, I've fallen for, he's run okay to my mind, Good Samaritan. You know, you mentioned him, JK, as a potential hanger, and I didn't like that too much, and I still don't like it after this performance, just because, again, I feel like, you know, give this horse a race where they go fast to the mile, as you'd expect them to do in important grass races with big purses, and I think you're going to see a very different Good Samaritan in the lane. Am I wrong to keep believing here?
No, I don't think you're wrong to keep believing. When you mentioned Good Samaritan, I did get I don't want to say annoying because that's not really fair, but just kind of a text or a tweet about the fact that Joel picked Good Samaritan, and clearly he was right by getting off of Yoshida and picking Good Samaritan because Good Samaritan ran better. I completely disagree with that.
Yeah, but that doesn't sound right at all. Various reasons, including. You know, some political stuff behind the scenes. Like there might not have been any picking about it. That could be commitments to important clients that, you know, you ruffle feathers if you start trying to micromanage too much. I'm guessing that was the situation as opposed to, and you know me, I love Good Samaritan. And in my mind, the jury's still out over who's going to be the better horse between Good Samaritan and Yoshida to some degree. But I don't think that what happened to the Belmont Derby is a particularly relevant data point to that conversation.
Well, to be fair, when you said clients and commitments, it was the same ownership. It was
Windstar. I know that it's Windstar, but even within Windstar, there are, you know, when you say you're going to do something to your client, I mean, I don't know that this is what happened. So I'm just guessing here. But this is,
well, I know what happened. If you want to guess, and then I'll tell you, I know exactly what happened. But I'll guess first.
You make a commitment to ride a certain horse in a certain race. And at that point, maybe another horse you ride shows up in that race, but maybe it's a little bit weird to go to your important client and be like, oh, you know what? I actually want to ride your other horse in this race. Like, I don't think it really works that way. I think that the client and or the trainer are going to be the ones much more likely to be working out the finer points of that as opposed to the rider. Now you tell me am I anywhere with that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think this is top secret enough, or anything, so I don't feel bad saying it. But essentially what happened was Joel was the full-time committed rider for Good Samaritan. And the only reason that he got the mount on Yoshida was because Jose committed to ride everything for Clement on Preakness Day. So he was off. Joel was on. But it didn't change the fact that Joel was committed to Good Samaritan full-time.
Yeah, that's very similar to what I was my little mental exercise there. So yeah, but let's get right to enough in the weeds on the jockey stuff. I did justify that tangent because we've had a lot of people ask us those type of questions, and that's just a perfect example of all the weird stuff that goes on behind the scenes that if you didn't hear, you wouldn't know. Let's talk Yoshida for a second. Do you see an excuse for this performance?
I kind of thought Johnny grabbed him a little bit more than I would have liked to, but he just wasn't very good. So I can't really blame Johnny for that whole thing.
Didn't do a lot of running. There was some bumping. There was like a very, the horse was not in a comfortable position really going into the first turn. But I mean, I will acknowledge that I'm reaching for excuses for a horse that I like, who I'm going to probably want to bet back at a better price next time, as opposed to saying, oh yeah, it was a subtle, horrible trip or anything. I don't think it was a subtle, horrible trip. I think there was, you know, enough excuses to go around. Among those is the distance, possibly one.
I don't think so. I mean, it's hard to get a mile and a quarter when you're not relaxed early. I don't care who you are. You're going to be dang Frankel. So, you know, the fact that he wasn't really listening to Johnny early, I think had a lot to do with it. But I also kind of wish Johnny wouldn't have asked him to do it. Wouldn't have fought him and just kind of let him go on with it a little bit.
But so in terms of horses, you'd be apt to bet back, evaluate the two we've just been talking about, Yoshida and Good Sam.
Yeah, I've got no problem with either one of those. Either one of them would work for me in a bet back situation. Good Samaritan, I could still see myself getting involved with, and I'll give Arklow another shot.
Well, with Good Samaritan at this point for me, I would want to have like a pressing reason to believe that the pace was going to be hot before thinking of him much more as a third and fourth type horse. Yoshida for me, I would just almost be like, let's see how the horse is training. He's training well. He's had some time. Let's draw a line through it and let's see if we don't see the horse that we expected to see in the Belmont Derby. Or how do you feel about those two evaluations?
Well, I'd like to see Yoshida with the trip he had at Keeneland when he broke his maiden. I want to see him, you know, I want to see him blast to the front, let the rider let him have his head and let him go on with it and kind of bury horses with all that class. That's what I'd like to see. But obviously the last two trips, he was coming from off the pace.
Well, and the two back trip where he was so impressive, I don't think that was by design, right? Didn't he just break bad and then made that wacky, crazy, visually impressive move?
Exactly. Missed the break and that's what, and then he kind of just ended up there.
And the way he resented the restraint this last time, you got to figure, you know, these are sharp people involved. I'm thinking the trip that you're seeing, go to the lead, improve your position, might be the exact one that he gets next time out. Try to let him at least get clear, more of, give him a chance to be more of a push button type horse, as opposed to a real like stalk and pounce kind of trip that I think Johnny was trying for in the Derby that we saw didn't work out. Let's talk Arklow. What excuses did you see for him?
I didn't really see any. He just wasn't very good. Obviously, I would have preferred him be not good on Derby Day and be good today. But
you're never going to get over that, are you?
It's tough. The more and more I think about it, it's rough.
It's that wind picture of Arklow you have hanging in your office that Elliot sent you. That's what's got you fixated on this. The reason I assumed you saw an excuse is I think you did say something about still being interested in betting him back. What's the theory behind that?
No, I just think he's a nice horse. And I think, you know, given the correct circumstances and allowing the connections to learn more about him, it's only his second turf race, right? So maybe there's something that he doesn't want to do. Maybe he doesn't like this, that, or that. Or maybe he wants to have this, this, and this done.
Third turf race, I believe.
I'm sorry, it's his third turf race. Yeah, I'm sorry. The Derby Day was his second. So, you know, there's still a lot to be learned about him, I think, from the connections. And so he's shown a lot of talent. So I don't have a problem giving him another shot. I'm not going to cut in line to bet him next time, but he's definitely one that I'll consider.
You mean cut in line like our guest later in the show, Anthony Robb, did in front of Eric Bylick at a Vegas contest back in January? Never mind. Inside joke. Let's move on to talk about the Belmont Oaks, a race that did feature a pretty hot pace and was won by New Money Honey, who was lying close to those numbers. Interesting figure disagreement on this one. Beyer came back with a fairly modest 88, whereas the time form number I thought I wrote it down. I think it was quite a bit higher. I'll look that up. I'm sorry. I thought I had it in my notes here, and I don't. But I believe that Timeform had that rated better than Beyer did. What did you think of New Money, Honey?
I thought she ran well. I mean, to be honest, I was fixated on Sister Charlie, another example of needing a horse for your lungs. We were alive in a lot of different situations. I had an ice cold pick three that started with the one turning practical joke to the biscuits, to Mind Your Biscuits, to Sister Charlie. So I needed Sister Charlie, and I thought Johnny gave her a really good ride. It looked like he was going to be wide coming into the final turn. And when you look to the head on, I watched it on NBC, they kind of showed that blimp view, and he actually got her into the two path for a majority of that turn, saving a lot of ground. And she just, she's going to win a lot of races over here. Just, you know, not much of an excuse, but she just couldn't get there.
Yeah. I mean, from just a racing flow point of view, you'd like New Money Honey a lot better coming out of that, because the setup was there for a closing run, even as far back as she was. Just looking at the coding in Timeform US or the flow figures, you'd still upgrade New Money Honey and downgrade Sister Charlie out of it. But you like Sister Charlie more going forward, would you say?
Well, I just think that, you know, Chad didn't even have her, right? I mean, now she's in there. She's in the Chad barn, the Chad operation, the Chad program. And just feels like there's going to be a Saturday at Saratoga where I'm going to have an opportunity to single her and hope that I can hit some other legs.
That's such a good point, and I'm so glad you made it. Even though she's going out for Chad Brown, you know, she'd run whatever it was within a few weeks overseas. Now you get a real chance to know her, get her into the program, and the Chad Brown improvement you'd expect her to make is coming now. It hasn't come already. So probably don't get too hung up. And I'm saying this to myself as much as the listeners. Don't get too hung up on the seeming flow downgrade of that. I feel bad. I'm going to talk to, hopefully he's listening, I'm going to talk to producer Craig during the show. I told him we were going to play the Anthony interview at 5:30, but I don't want to give, we're going to be a few minutes late, because I don't want to give short shrift to these other races at Belmont. First, any other thoughts coming out of the Oaks, the Chad Brown 1-2-3 there?
No, I thought New Money Honey ran really well. She kind of set that slow pace last time. I didn't think she was going to run that well this time. She really did. So, no, nothing that really grabbed me in that race.
All right, let's move on and talk about. You referenced the one turn horse. You've been a champion of several ideas that I heard a lot of talking points about over the weekend. One. This idea, this is relating back to Arklo, this idea that Brad Cox is going to sort of be like the next big trainer winning graded stakes on turf. Another idea, of course, that you've been talking about for a long time, as have many analysts, the idea of Practical Joke as the one-turn horse. Gee, it sure looked like it there. Slow fraction set by Battalion Runner didn't matter. Practical Joke gets the job done. 101 on the Beyer scale, 103, basically like a 123, I think it was, Timeform US. Oh, one little bit of errata as well. New Money Honey's Timeform U.S. figure was a 120. I meant to mention that. I'm sorry. But back to the Dwyer for a second. How good is Practical Joe?
I thought he was super impressive. Another really impressive thing, and I wish I remembered exactly how it was, but I'm sure if people were watching, they saw it. The late click, the late money that he took, I mean, someone must have made a huge win bet on him. I think there was $600,000 in the pool. And I want to say he went from like, I want to say maybe even money to, or maybe 4-5 to like 1-2, like in the like, or 2-5, like in the last, I mean, it was a big, big win bet. When they show it right before they load and then it flashes again. It was a significant bet someone made on that horse late. So I thought he ran really well. It was pretty impressive. He looked like he was always going to be a winner from the quarter pole. And I think that's a kind of an indication of a good performance when you know they're going to win at the top of the stretch or at the quarter pole, it's kind of one of those things where it was never in doubt and makes you feel like there's probably a little bit left there. I think
3-5 in the end. 3-5 in the end for Practical Joke. Despite those slow fractions, Battalion Runner just gets blown up, ends up getting passed for second by Tale of Silence at a big, big number, 43-1 for Barkley Tag. But yeah, Practical Joke, that was an effort. when a horse can do it without having it against a theoretically worthy rival who has a tactical advantage, and you just destroy that horse and do it in a fashion that suggests there's more in the tank. You go ahead.
Oh, well, I was going to say that, you know, what I'm worried about is what are they going to do? I mean, I really want them to run in the King's Bishop.
King's Bishop, right?
The Alan Jerkins, excuse me.
Oh, right. The Alan Jerkins.
You better get that together.
Yeah.
But, you know, it feels like they're going to do something where they try to run him in the Haskell. You know what I mean? Like, because they got cloud computing.
Really?
They got cloud computing for the Travers situation, you know, for the Jim Dandy and the Travers. So, I mean, I hope they don't, but I worry that I don't know. It's Klarovich and it's Saratoga, so hopefully that's what they do. I just worry they'll get the two-turn bug in them again and try the Haskell.
It's possible, and I mean that is a course where if you had to pick a course for a one-turn type a horse you thought was going to be better at one turn to run two turns, the race you pick would probably be the Haskell, but I don't know. He's not a front runner. I don't know. My first gut was negative the Haskell idea, but I do see your points about why that might come to be. Let's talk about the Belmont Sprint Championship quickly, Jonathan. You know, I sat there with you at Santa Anita last year, and I said, all right, no matter what happens in the sprint division next year, I don't want to bet East Coast speed horses in the Breeders' Cup Sprint. It seems like they come in every year, and I want to bet them, and they don't seem to be able to match up to the California horses. I'm feeling it again now. I'm feeling like Mind Your Biscuits is so good that he has to be considered at the top of the class for the Breeders' Cup Sprint. What do you think of that idea, and what do you think of his race in general?
Well, first of all, Mind Your Biscuits hit the board in the Breeders' Cup last year, didn't he, Sprint? Did he run second or third?
Second, I think.
Yeah. So that's a positive sign. The other thing is as a kind of a late runner, I mean, he's not like a dead, you know, he's not Midnight Loot coming from last, but the chances are he's going to be circling horses in the sprint at Del Mar. And if that track is paying anything like it was last year, outside of where you wanted to be, he would have a legit chance trying to run down one of those California sprinters that's probably in the inside that was on the lead. So I wouldn't hit submit bet yet on that one, but I get where you're coming from. He's an impressive horse. What a cool horse. I mean, I haven't been around the game long enough to start throwing around the idea that he's one of the best New York breds ever, but at least maybe sprinters, right? Or am I speaking blasphemous? Is there someone else I'm ignoring?
For a New York bred sprinter? I can't, nobody leaps. Yeah. I mean, I've only been doing it for 20 years, but in that time, his name would be at the top.
Yeah, what a cool horse, and maybe we can put a pin in the Dubai bounce theory. We'll see if Arrogant can make us feel a little bit better about that as well.
Yeah, I don't want to put a pin in it at this point. I want to just erase it. I do think it was once a thing. I think in the early years when it hadn't been done that often, there were some instances where trainers didn't really have a program, have a way of doing it. But I feel like in recent years, trainers have gotten so much better about it, figuring out the nuances of it. And it just doesn't, I don't think it's the data I've seen on it. The data I've seen hasn't been fully comprehensive, but the data I've seen makes it seem like one of those things that people just say, but isn't necessarily real, at least not anymore. As good as Mind Your Biscuits is, I did give him too much credit. He was only third in the Breeders' Cup Sprint, not second. So I don't want to let that little bit of misinformation out there.
He also did win the Malibu.
Yeah, he's won out there. Yeah,
not for the lighthearted.
So yeah, I so who knows? Maybe I'm gonna have to go right back to the well with my East Coast based horses in the Breeders' Cup Sprint, despite the promises I made to myself. Any excuse for Unified in here? I sure didn't see one.
Yeah. I mean, I think his excuse is he's not that good.
Right.
I don't mean that to be ugly. I mean, I'd love to own him. And God bless the people that do. He just really didn't have an excuse. And this is a couple of times now where I just remember him just blowing up with no excuse, just not running well. And so I just don't think he's that good. Maybe they should try something different with him. I don't remember who's he by. Is he it's on the tip of my tongue. I can't.
Of course,
remember
you asked this on a day where you don't have your computer.
I know, I'm computerless. I want to say it's like someone will text us. Maybe Matt will text us and tell us. He'll be our
Candy
cheat
Ride.
Candy Ride. Yeah, so maybe he's got a little turfy in him. Maybe they can try to see if that'll wake him up.
It's just the kind of horse where once everybody gives up and you find the right spot, not a horse you're going to key your day around, but a horse you can maybe smartly find a way to include that can come back and win another big race at a price. This horse has a lot of talent, has some legit excuses. In my view, maybe some will disagree with me. I know this is another horse that everyone thought hung in the Carter. And I just, the way that racetrack was that day, I just can't hold that race against him as much as I think some people did. Obviously, this just complete no-show. We'll see. Follow the news. Look at the workout reports. Maybe this is a horse that can find the right spot and win at a price down the line. I wouldn't give up completely, but I don't exactly have a logical reason for saying that other than, you know, the never-ending quest for value that maybe he could be down the line coming off such an ugly running line. Any other thoughts? I know you had some close calls on the day. Any just wagering stories before we bring in Anthony Rupp?
No. There's no one wants to hear these wagering stories. It's no.
Oh, what about Rubalinda? I thought you told me you had a good story about Rubalinda.
Oh, no. It was not a good story. It's a story, but it's not a good one.
Does it go go something like this? I almost won a lot of money and I should have won a lot of money, but I lost. Because if that's all it is, we don't need to tell it. But if there's any there, if there's anything, any teachable moments in this train wreck, then I do want you to tell it.
Well, I think there is a teachable moment and maybe it's something we can talk about. I don't know if you've had a chance to see it yet, so maybe we'll save it for Friday. But like, was it a bad ride or was it a bad trip?
Interesting. I'll take a look. I'll be honest. I haven't seen that one yet. So let's wait. Let's remember and let's come back to it for Friday's show. So, all right, if you don't have anything else for Belmont, it sounds like you're square.
Square as an even? No, I'm not even on that.
No, square, yeah. Like you don't have anything else to say about Saturday.
That was just a desperate attempt for me to for people to feel sorry for me for losing on Sunday.
Nobody feels sorry for you, Jonathan. You're the people's champion for a reason. You're not here. We're not here to throw a pity party. You'll be back in short order. But let's bring in today's guest. Joining me now for his first appearance on the DRF Players Podcast is my friend Anthony Rupp. Anthony, how are you doing today?
Good morning, Peter. I'm good today, actually.
You're known in the contest world by many monikers. On my old blog, I think I christened you Hurricane Anthony for the way that you would blow into Saratoga, leaving all manner of wreckage in your wake. I've heard you referred to as Tony Gold in certain corners, but today it's just Anthony Rupp for the podcast. Now, I have had a request, a long-standing request that you're going to help me fulfill today, Tony.
Yes. And, yep.
A couple of years ago, there was a publicized incident where some tournament player, no one I had ever heard of, had simply played one number in a contest. I think in that case, it was all the fours. Played number four in every race and ended up winning a valuable prize. And I was instructed that I should track that person down and interview them. I never did that. But when I saw that you, a respected tournament player who I know knows how to study form and spends a lot of time studying replays, understands the game, has been involved in the ownership side of the game, et cetera, et cetera. When I saw your name at the top of a leaderboard this weekend and clicked and saw that you won your way into a major Vegas tournament by playing all the ones, I knew I just had to have you on the show. What the heck happened?
Well, I got to tell you the backstory. Okay, prior to even playing in tournaments, I often used to, like in Australia, you know, the number one horse is always the top weighted horse. So when they do the numbers for the horses, so the one, in a handicap event, the one carrying the most weight is always the one, and often the best horse, you know, sometimes outweighted. you know, by the handicapper. But if I was playing a pick four, we call it a quaddie, but a pick four in Australia, you know, I would often just include the one horse, regardless of price, regardless of anything. You know, I do my kind of handicapping, and then I just add the one in every leg. And the amount of times that one of those ones turned up was uncanny. So, you know, flash forward years later, you know, when I started playing tournaments, which you got me, you know, introduced me to, I noticed, like, quite a few times, you know, in the back of my head, I was always like, oh, I wonder how the ones will do today, you know. and one particular day, you know, tournaments are not cheap, I actually nearly played the ones. This is about 2 years ago. And halfway through the tournament, I was kicking myself. Three of them had come off. One of them was not a cap, but it was a big price. And literally, I would have been leading the table half. Now, to be honest, I wouldn't have won had I stuck with the ones for the entire tournament. But I think it was like a top 10 finish. It was whatever. So, you know, the other week, as you know, I had a pretty rough day, Belmont Day at the track, and I put a lot of work in those 2 days. Kind of got screwed out of a pick five the day before and whatever. And I'd only played a couple of tournaments, really, in the last 2 months. And I was going to a pool party on Sunday, and I looked at entering this tournament, and I thought, well, I just looked at all the ones, and they all looked prices, and I had a really quick look to, you know, see if, you know, I was just reaching ridiculously. I was like, you know what, I'm going to play all the ones today, because none of them were short prices, except one might have been 5-1. And I'm like, you know what, if I get lucky today, I've just had so much bad luck lately. And then I did have some sort of intention of maybe having a look halfway through, and if I got really lucky, then actually handicapping the rest of the card.
In a live event, you have that benefit, of course. And in fact, I do advise people, and I'm sure I've given you this advice too, when you sign up for the contest, as soon as you can make picks, there's no reason not to pick all of something, whether it's every favorite, every horse ridden by John Velasquez, every number one, just so you have something in there should life go awry, should you forget, et cetera, at least you'd have something.
So absolutely, and you've got a much better chance of, like, doing, like, what you said, or, you know, Joel Rosario in every race. Like, he's probably going to win one race, right? So it's better than having absolutely nothing in there. But that was not really the point. I mean, I had made the mistake of rushing, you know, prior to a pick and pray quite a few times, and actually ended up, like, trying to canceling because it was so. So that was part of it. But it was like, I kind of did have a pretty strong intention to just play the ones and see how the chips fell. Look, if all the ones had been, you know, 7-2 and 5-1 or whatever, I probably wouldn't have done it. But when they just looked like very open races, and if all the ones were, like, you know, morning line 12-1, 15-1 or whatever. And I ended up, you know, hitting a capper, and then another capper ran second. And that was all it took. I couldn't believe it when I looked at the leaderboard.
I've got to believe you're interrupting part of the story here, because you used a key couple of words before, and those key words were pool party. So I'm assuming that, you know, you're, like, downplaying, like, you almost did this intentionally. I'm going to guess that closer to the truth is you put them in as your default picks. And, I mean, you must have figured to look around the third or fourth race to see what was happening. I'm just assuming you got swept up in the pool party, and, you know, we all know how that can happen. And then, you know, you looked late. Explain exactly what happened during the day.
Okay, so in the morning, I got up very early on Sunday morning, and I didn't get up thinking I was going to play all the ones. But when I looked at it, and I always look at see, you know, what are the ones prices on the ones? And it's just the stars aligned. They all were big prices, all of them. And I'm like, well, you know what? One or two of them win, you know. So then I gave it a quick glance at the form, you know, a couple of notes in a few different databases I look at, like a very, like, 5 minutes probably max. and it just glanced. Yeah, just glanced, just literally glanced over, you know, some, you know, public handicappers picks and this and that, and just sort of glanced at, you know, a few stats, like, but very, very briefly. And I was like, you know what? I think I'm going to play all the ones today. I'm not sure. I wasn't sure. So I put them in, and then I had breakfast and dilly-dallied around, and then I was going to go back, and I was like, you know what? Let's do it today. You know, I guess because the last few weeks, or I haven't had a bet for a couple of weeks, actually, which is pretty strange for me, but I just decided to have a little tiny break, and I was like, you know what? Today's the day to play the ones. Now, back to your question about was I tempted to look? I absolutely was. But you know what? I had a funny gut feeling that I shouldn't be looking. I should just totally tune out and look at the end of the day. And I did think about it on three or four occasions. I went to look in, and I actually, when I did look in, there was one race to go when I looked in. That's when I looked. There was one race to go, and seconds. $9 obviously wasn't going to change the one.
It had worked to that point. Now, I did notice there was one race where you played a 5-horse. What happened there?
Well, there was no one in the race.
The one had scrapped.
Now,
okay.
But five, if you did notice, all my alts were fives.
Right.
So they're the two. Five's the other number because five's a good gate. And I don't know, that would be the other number if I did it again. That would be the other number.
Well, have you thought about applying this strategy going forward? I mean, are you just going to – is it the kind of thing where to continue to – do you feel like to continue to do this is now your new thing? Or do you feel like that's like finding a $20 bill on the street and then returning to that same spot every day expecting to find another $20 bill?
Yeah, look, let's be honest. I got really lucky. I also don't want to lose all respect in the handicapping world for doing that. So I'm going to go back to actually, you know, I'm going to take my win and go with it. I'm not saying I'll never do it again, but you know, it's a fairly big investment, these tournaments, so I'm not about burning money on all the ones. But listen, I'm sure there'll be another day I will maybe play all the ones on a second entry, you know, something like that.
Well, congratulations on the big win, however ill-earned it might be. I've also seen you put in the work plenty of days and get nosed out of some big scores.
Absolutely. I almost feel guilty, but I really don't, because I've had those days where I've put in hours of work. And so I'm going to take it.
All right. Well, you mentioned your Australian racing background before. I just want to ask you, I'll let you get out of here in a minute, but just want to ask you a couple questions about that. That was interesting what you said about, and it made sense, in a handicap race in Australia or the UK or Ireland, top weights, number one. Obviously, that does not apply here, though you do have the fact of a lot of dirt racing and maybe an inherent advantage sometimes on a day where the inside is good with playing the one. It doesn't sound like that factored into it. But I was just curious, more generally speaking, what other aspects of form study or handicapping that you picked up in your native land have helped you in your handicapping contest play and your general play in the USA?
Oh, definitely. I actually look at the weights. I don't think a lot of handicappers in America put too much emphasis on the weights. I mean, I know it's been talked about before, but I really do, you know, have a look if somebody's getting a really big break, even if they've got a bug. I tend to lean towards a horse like that, especially if it's coming up in class and it's getting that big break, you know, that might be all it needs. So that's an angle that I use. Definitely.
Are you planning on participating? I know you've played in past years in the Saratoga tournaments. Any thought of bringing your, you know, play all the ones to a live bankroll format in Saratoga potentially?
I mean, that'd be pretty ballsy, but yeah. I mean, I'm in the hut. You know what? I just bought into the Huddy contest. So
maybe the infamous Huddy contest. I don't think we've ever talked about that on the podcast. Yes, the sort of underground contest that a lot of industry people are in. So yeah, that's maybe some Sunday comes and you have picks left for the week, and you could go ahead and look for the ones who are 12-1 or higher and throw them in Huddy. But how about seeing you live up in Saratoga? Is that going to happen this year?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, you do know I'm an investor in the Lonro cult, No Worries Mate, by Buena Venture Stables. So I'm very excited about Saratoga this year. You'll see me up there quite a bit, as you know. I'll be up there for the big stable event on the 28th, and which is my birthday weekend, actually, and the stable has an event. And then, of course, the Travis weekend, and hopefully a few other times. There is still the big Saratoga tournament this year, is there?
Indeed, Wednesday, Thursday. It's two separate tournaments now. It's a live bankroll format, but that's one that a lot of contest players will be coming in from all over. If you see Tony up there, if you can show him proof that you were one of the people he beat in the contest where he played all the ones, I'm pretty sure he'll buy you a pint. Fair?
Fair.
Excellent. All right, Anthony. Thank you so much for taking the time out to join us today. Good luck, and hopefully the next time I bring you on the show, it will be for perhaps a slightly prouder win.
No worries. Just remember all the ones.
Cheers, buddy. There you have it, my buddy Anthony Robb. He's crazy, isn't he, JK?
Certified nuts. The guy's hilarious, though. I enjoy hanging out with him. I mean, not that he needs a co-signer, but he does the work. He got caught in a situation where obviously he had a lot of stuff going on. He's got a little fella running around as well, and that sometimes can catch you off guard. And
we know how that goes.
Yeah, so you know he probably bought into the tournament on Saturday night and woke up and was going to look at it, and then got called to do some chores or to do something. And next thing he knew, it was 12:27, and the tournament started in 8 minutes, so he just threw in some ones because what else was he going to do but burn his money? you know, I've done that a few times, but I've never done it because I was in trouble. Like, I was like, oh, dang, I got to hurry up. The times I've done it is when I'd be playing and I'd have two entries. And, you know, when you look at this and you look at your entry, you can kind of see the colors. And if I saw a lot of one color on my second entry, I would just turn it into all one thing. Like, if I saw, like, I had a lot of twos as my primary pick, a lot of twos as my alternates, you know, there's 12 races and I got eight twos, then just for the fun of it, I'd say, what the heck, I'll just turn my alternate pick into all twos. And just to jack around, you know, for $15, $16, never for 100 or 200, anything like that. But, you know, it's fun. It's at the end of the day, if someone wants to put their money in an irresponsible way, I don't understand why that would upset people.
Right. Once in a while, it is going to work. I will say this, as the guy who introduced Tony to contests, it doesn't exactly like it does. I don't exactly feel covered in glory. Let's put it that way. When I have one of the people who I introduced to contests winning in such a way. But I mean, the right attitude. I once interviewed the professional poker player, Clonie Gowan, and I was talking to her about bad beats, and she said that when she has a bad beat, you know, she gets rivered on some two outer or whatever, it actually not only doesn't upset her, it makes her happy, because if there's people playing against her making bad decisions, that means in the long run, that money's going to be flowing back to them. So what I'd like to tell tournament players is when you hear stories about somebody playing all the ones and winning, rather than it upsetting you, knowing there are people out there playing in games, and, you know, Tony isn't doing this all the time, but, you know, somebody's doing stuff like that. If JK is copping to doing it once in a while, we heard Anthony's story. If people are playing with that little of an edge, and you're competing directly against them in tournaments, these are people you want to be competing against. It probably shouldn't make you unhappy. It should make you happy that in a game selection way, that these kind of opportunities are out there to play against these people. But I suspect, though, that most players aren't like that. Most tournament players, this probably makes crazy. True?
Yeah, it probably does. But that's just because horse players in general like to complain. but here's the thing. It's very similar to the topic we talked about last week with David Landsman making the $1,000 straight try bet that paid $22 and he had it 1,000 times. Like, look, yeah, that it was unfortunate that day that he did something, you know, that was a poor bet. It was a poor strategy. It's a strategy that won't give you a return in the long run, but he hit it, and good for him. You know what I mean? If you played that try, you would have had your payout would have been, and you would have hit your try. Your payout would have been better because he bet $1,000 straight try, and you know, so you got to appreciate those types of situations and not let them get to you. Unfortunately, they're going to bite you every now and then.
Yeah, I just think most players, when they see somebody winning, I guess here's the other thing, and maybe this is my bias as somebody who's like, you know, obviously, for reasons that should be obvious if they're not already, somebody like me who's completely in the tank for tournaments, does it make tournament players look bad?
No, I don't think so at all. I mean,
The whole stabbing thing. There's some people, oh, tournament players. I mean, you must have heard this. They're just stabbers. They're playing these horses who are prices. Oh, tournaments, that's not real. You can win it by just playing all the ones, blah, blah, blah. Like,
well, if you can't beat a guy that picked all ones, then you need to reevaluate your game.
You're talking about on a regular basis. Not
right, yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, no, I mean, I get it. You know, if you were a guy that got third, fourth, or fifth, you had a good day, and that cost you, I could understand the slight annoyance, but at the same time, it's in the long run, you'll be fine with people doing that. I mean, I wish I could play in a tournament where half the field picked all the same number.
Our buddy Brent Sumja, I believe it was Brent, once gave me a great quote about talking about, he was explaining gambling to a non-gambler. And I think it was some instance that's a little bit analogous to this where, you know, he was at a track, he'd done his work. He's looking at the horses in every race in the paddock. He's, you know, studied the sheets and done everything else that he does to prepare for a day of racing. And he didn't do well. And somebody went and, you know, bet on the horse with the longest tail in every race. And that person made, you know, $1,000 and Brent had lost on this day. And he and someone was asking, like, well, doesn't that make you feel like it's not worth it to do all the work that you do? And he said, no, absolutely not. On a given day, that's possible. In a week, if I'm playing heads up against that person, they could beat me. Even in a month, maybe one time out of 10, two times out of 10, they're going to beat me. But you give me a year playing heads up against somebody betting on the horse with the longest tail, and you know they're going to have absolutely no chance. And if you don't take that long view of the gambling situation, you're going to subject yourself to a lot more frustration than you need to have in your life. What do you think about that concept?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things. It's like you can be aggravated about him picking all ones because you can visually see that. It's very easy to see, especially when the way that the sites typically will display those graphics. But what if it was a guy that only picked – you know, he picked every horse that had a jot from Puerto Rico, or, you know, it's something hidden. He had a.
You better have multiple entries, JK.
Right, or only even numbers, or only horses that were trained by female trainers, or something weird like that. You would have never known. Like, it's one of those things that's way too out of your control to get upset about.
First, for a full disclosure here, before I got Anthony's redboarding tweet about his contest win. In which, by the way, the first words were not, and I played all the ones. It was just, hey, I want a seat to this prestigious tournament. But before I got that tweet, I got a tweet or text. I got a text from you, which was simply the card with all the ones. You had noticed it before I even heard about it from the horse's mouth. When you first sent that to me, before you heard any of his explanation, etc., were you doing it like, geez, can you believe this guy? Were you doing this like, oh, isn't this awesome? Anthony's going to be with us out in Vegas. What was motivating you to send me that text?
I don't even remember who sent it to me. I wasn't watching or playing along.
You forwarded it to me. You didn't.
Yeah, someone sent it to me, and I just forwarded it along. I think what I said was, I think if it would have been in person, I would have showed you the picture. I said, Pete, look at your boy. That's probably how I would have verbalized it.
That's great.
I probably just sent it without the text. But
I guarantee it was Eric Bylick. He's still bitter about Anthony supposedly cutting in front of him at Treasure Island to place a $1,000 show bet on the Pegasus Stakes last year. A bet which did cash, by the way.
Why does it feels like you know, Eric and Ryan Flanders, everybody wants to complain they're getting cut in front of at the in Vegas. I don't understand.
That's really funny, because that's another thing those two, Ryan and Eric, have in common. Not only the cut in front of story, but also when one of those days where you played all the twos, I'm pretty sure it was a head-to-head against Ryan, and I'm pretty sure this was when you two were going head-to-head for the tour title a few years ago, and Ryan, who I'd interviewed, was like, I know you're friends with this guy, but this is just ridiculous. Like, he was super upset with the fact that you beat him playing all twos. Perhaps it gave you a psychological advantage, JK, in the tour hunt that year.
Oh, yeah, I had him when that was over. When I cut in front of him, allegedly, he was on the edge, and then once I got him there, he was mentally defeated from that point on. Actually, I ran into him at Santa Anita, and we had a little heated discussion about. I told him he still couldn't warm me up. So if he ever wanted to have a little head to head series, and so he was it was heated. It was fun though.
I'm sure DRF tournaments would make room for that. We are out of time. We're going to have to save our Saratoga Del Mar preview, which is probably good. We don't want to rush that anyway. Maybe we can give that 20 minutes either on the late week show. Not exactly sure when the late week show will be. We may do it Thursday. We may do it Friday. JK, you're making a rare public appearance on Friday. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I'm going to there's a new OTB restaurant opening in Sanford, Connecticut. It's part of the Bobby Valentine's chain that they have. And so there's a little seminar from 12 to 2. So I'm going to make a quick Northeast arrival. I'm going to show up probably Thursday night, hit that on Friday, and then head back to an airport and get back to Austin. I can't miss Austin's game on Sunday. Saturday. I got to be back for that. So.
Very, very, very wise. And if folks are there and sticking around for the day, I'm going to be coming up. It's sort of like a tag team operation. JK will leave, and I will be there to talk tournaments around 5 o'clock. This Bobby V's teletheater up in Stamford going to be running a tournament, I believe, either over this weekend or in the near future. This is the big opening weekend ceremony. We'd love if you come out to see us. That'd be a ton of fun. And again, that's all the time we have. I want to thank Anthony Robb. I want to thank Jonathan Kinchin. I want to thank producer Craig for sticking with us and helping us out today. Most of all, I want to thank all of you for listening. Hit us up, podcast@drf.com. We'll get to a bunch of questions in the coming shows. I'm Peter Thomas Fornital. May you win all your photos.